Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 2, delivered on August 24, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Financial System.
Now, when I am going into a lecture like this, the thing that I want to show you is all the different types of companies that are out there. But before I can do that, I do want to talk to you about where we stand in terms of what kinds of regulatory environment exists in finance and in related fields, and talk to you about the history of how we got to this place where we are now. First things first was that there was a powerful set of financial laws governing financial transactions, financial institutions, that were put into place in the 1930s. Because the 1920s were the roaring 20s, where anything could go, and cheating, lying, stealing in the financial world was the norm. And a lot of people lost their shirts when the crash happened in 29 and in the years after that. But the truth of the matter is that the problems that came to a head in 29 and the years after that had been building for years. Our government, since the founding of this country, was the best government that money could buy. The concept of a broad democracy was kind of a joke because things were decided. What candidates would run for office, who was going to be the judge appointed, who were going to be the commissioners of the few regulatory agencies. Those were decided literally in smoke-filled back rooms by overweight fat men of pale skin. And it finally led to a disaster called the Great Depression. And when the elections of 1932 came, the ruling party and the ruling philosophy, economic philosophy behind that party was just kicked out of office. The rats were chased out of Washington, and a new era began that was led by a president named Franklin D. Roosevelt. And the Congress that had originally been there was all replaced with Roosevelt's allies. The Supreme Court was not on his side because Supreme Court justices are appointed by presidents over periods of long years and they just live the rest of their lives there. So Roosevelt had the Supreme Court to battle, but he won that battle when he scared the crap out of them with one threat. Franklin Roosevelt the Congress and Roosevelt did many, many reforms that stood to modern times. Everything from labor laws that protected workers in their jobs and protected their right to unionize, on through to laws regarding something as simple as a minimum wage. Laws that govern the sales of securities in the primary market and in the secondary market. I'll explain that to you in a while, in this lecture. Laws that cracked down on banks and their scams and their swindles. At one point, Franklin Roosevelt said openly, "The wealthy despise me and I welcome that." And they went on to put it together a world that before me even, the world where we had a great war where we kicked the ass on two full theaters of bad people. We grew like a blockbuster through the 50s, through the 60s, even through the 70s and in the 80s, we knocked down the wall. Finally, at the end of the 80s and in the 90s, we knocked down the wall of a full-blown adversary empire. That's what you inherited in that world of those regulatory laws that were iron fists over everything from how companies treat their workers to how banks and stockbrokers treat their clients. And that world is gone now. Most of those laws have been taken away. The banking laws were called, fell under the Glass-Steagall Act. Oops, I start right off misspelling. I think I still misspelled it there. That cracked down on the banks. One of the things that it did was to make a Chinese wall between banks and investments. See, it was back in the old days, before this, a bank could be underwriting a stock offering by you, Mr. Big Corporation. And then they could be telling you, one of their depositors, oh, buy this stock, knowing full well that if they get it off their books, they don't no longer care how corrupted your corporation was, how likely it was to fail. You see, they could do that. Glass-Steagall protected you, wouldn't let them do that. Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999 under the neoliberal president, Bill Clinton, interestingly. Okay, there were other laws, too, that I'll bring up. In securities, there were a pair of laws. The Securities Act of 1933. This regulated the primary sale of stock and other securities. In other words, suppose that some big mega corporation does its initial public offering, its IPO of stock. Let's say that corporation is something called Facebook. Now, Facebook issues its stock, millions of shares at a $40 a share or whatever. You are not going to buy that stock. That's not how it works. With these corporations like that, a syndicate of investment banks underwrites the offering. They buy your stock. You've issued, you're the big dog of Facebook. They issue that stock, we buy it up. And then we allocate that stock to our best customers. That's the primary market, is the buying of the stock from the company. The secondary market is where you would buy the stock from someone else who owns it. You understand? Okay? So you would be buying from another person. You are no longer involved. You got your money from the investment bankers minus their commissions. And then the rest of it is, from there. Here's how I could probably play it. I'm one of the investment bankers. I'm a trader, okay? So you're a rich, rich, handsome young man, wealthy, really great. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to get that stock to you at $40 a share. Then we're going to pump that stock in the media. Oh, there's such a frenzy. All these idiots on Financial News Network and all that just hype that stock. Buy, okay? That's you people starting to say, wow, I better get in on this. That pushes the price up, let's say, to $50 a share. And then what I do with you is, you're my good client. All right, it's time to dump. Get rid of it. And then we go out to the floor traders or the traders in the boiler room and we say, get this man's stock out of his portfolio. As the sales start to happen, the supply of the stock on the open market begins to expand. Supply goes up, price goes down, and all you suckers that I've gotten to buy the stock from him at 50, 48, 47, you watch the stock tail down into the 30s. Okay? Secondary market is where you're going to play. Don't think you're going to get in on a primary offering unless it's a small, cheapo corporation. Because the big corporations are going to do their offerings and have them bought up on guaranteed underwritings, what are called firm underwritings by underwriting syndicates of investment banks. There'll be a lead underwriter, a big dog investment bank, and he'll work out so the different investment banks in the syndicate take their allocations to sell to their good clients as well. The second of these, this pair, was the Securities Exchange Act. Whoops. Securities Exchange Act of 1934. That was the law that governed the secondary market. How the rules, the law, the do's and don'ts of selling market, selling stock that is not primary market. The vast majority of trading happens, of course, in the secondary market. Billions and billions of shares every day, not just stock, but bonds, other weird stuff. It's just a massive, insanely large market. Interestingly enough, and I'll bring this up again later, the stock market, which most people think about as the thing in finance, is actually dwarfed in size by the bond market. The bond market is 10 times the size of the stock market. But you don't hear so much about the bond market because it's not sexy. The price volatility is not nearly as much, and you'll see why. It's just a logical consequence of bonds versus stock. But it's a huge market. The volume in that is big. And so this is the one that day to day, compliance has to be watched much more carefully. There's more compliance that comes out of Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And we'll talk a lot about these. You don't need to memorize any details yet so much, except this is primary, this is secondary. Glass-Steagall was banking. But the truth of the matter is, let me put this back up here for just a second. I want to mention something. When I was in the consulting world, it was kind of weird because the Securities Exchange Commission, which is a regulatory commission that oversees the compliance with these two laws, the federal government's compliance with these two laws. In my time, you feared them in a way. In a way, they were scary. But they also were very helpful with corporations. As a consultant, I actually would call them. And the first thing that I had a couple of guys I knew there, and first thing they'd say is, well, we cannot give you any advice. And then for the next 30 minutes, they tell me, give me advice on how to do things right with respect to clients that had a stock, the things that they had to do. So there was more of a, I don't want to say collegial environment, but it was more of a working relationship. It changed in the early 2000s. There was much more of a hands-off Wild West approach, and that's what the next topic I'm going to talk about here in a minute. There was a lack of oversight that allowed for some madness to happen. Starting in the later 1990s, when I was pulling out, and going into the 2000s, I'll get to that in a second. But then all hell broke loose in 2007, but mostly in 2008, on one dark September day in 2008, things went sideways around the world in a way that most people don't know. We were probably within a couple of hours of having the entire global financial system collapse. Serious. No more money coming out of ATMs. Banks had no money to give you. Nothing. It could have been there. We were very close because of this Wild West. Oddly, though, it was in this same context at the beginning of the century that several scandals blew wide open and changed the face of regulation forever. Laws were passed frantically by Congress, not very well thought out in many ways, but there was this, we got to do something to make people not blame us in Congress and the president for what is going on here. Now, understand that these scandals began under President Bill Clinton and his neoliberal policies. They continued under George W. Bush and his conservative policies. But that shows you that there's really not so much of a difference. Both neoliberals and conservatives are pro-business. They believe that America becomes greater through the strength of its businesses. There's nothing wrong with that philosophy until you get down to some of the problems. This intersects with what I told you in the first lecture. As far as accounting goes, accounting has its role. It creates information products for different constituencies. It has to use numbers on paper, receipts, documented costs, documented sales. It has to. That's the only way it can work. And accounting has been around since we began to see accounting take hold. Rule-based accounting, the double accounting system, started with, believe it or not, I don't know if they tell you this in accounting, it started with a monk named Pacioli. He created the double accounting system. And the wealthy people who were the investors in all kinds of exploration and all of that, they began to require that companies that wanted money from them show them accounting statements so they could have some reliance on the worthiness of these explorers, of these traders, of these exploiters of resources. So that was a huge jump in the power that capitalism had to make an assurance for investors that there was something to be gained by doing these investments. You show me your financial statements that are done by, according to Pacioli's rules, that double accounting system we've heard about, and then we'll look at them and decide whether we want to put money into a couple of ships for you to go to the New World and bring some stuff back, or for you to go to the Orient and bring stuff back. So it had a huge influence. Accounting was the basis of how the engine of the Renaissance turned into the absolute powerhouse of the Industrial Revolution. That having been said, accounting does not recognize what in finance we know is absolutely crucial. Because, and you're going to see this when I talk about these scandals, it just stands out at you. But remember, accounting cannot look at opportunity cost because it's not there. It's not a receipt. Opportunity cost is the money that doesn't go into your pocket. Accounting cost is the money that's documented that comes out of your pocket. But opportunity cost is not something someone sees, but it drives our behavior. If the opportunity cost is too high, even though you'll never see the number, you'll quit something that you're doing. Other things like replacement cost. Replacement cost is what matters to investments, not the book value. So let me, with that as a background, let me tell you about a couple of the scandals that drove regulatory law. First one was Sarbanes-Oxley. SOX, as we call it. Seriously? Sarbanes-Oxley. SOX. Now, tell you some background. And I know one of these stories kind of, I have a personal side to knowing one of these stories. But let me start with the first real scandal, WorldCom. WorldCom was a love child of Wall Street, a company that had huge profit at the bottom of its income statement. The profit was gorgeous. I mean, it was just, it was almost as pretty as a 12-ounce filet mignon that I cook on a grill. Not quite, but almost there. WorldCom actually had a very simple trick that it was pulling, a gorgeous one. You see, when it would spend vast, large amounts of money, expenses, money out of the pocket of the corporation, what it would do is instead of putting those as expenses on the income statement, which would have killed profit, they capitalized the expenses to the balance sheet as assets. So you had a double effect. It was gorgeous. First of all, because the recognized expenses were low, revenue minus expenses, profit was enormous. Second, because those expenses were being capitalized as assets on the balance sheet, the assets of the corporation were massive. And investors said, oh my God, not only do they have these huge profit, but look at how their assets are going up over, year over year. Until the day that they had spent so much actual cash on expenses that their doors closed, rather unceremoniously. You see, the financial statements were in order, but what we care about in finance isn't profit, it's cash flow. Cash flow is king. Cash flow is king. Anyone who would have looked at the cash flows would have known that WorldCom was Tap City. It was a dead corpse walking. But everyone looks at that accounting profit and their eyes go all starry, and suddenly you've got a scandal, a huge, massive corporation that hundreds of thousands, millions of investors had put money into because all the financial gurus had said, oh, this is a buy. And there it went, Tap City, belly up. So there you go, a great example of where all they did was an accounting trick. This is part of what Sarbanes-Oxley cracked down. First, Sarbanes-Oxley put up a wall to end the incestuous relationships outside auditing firms had with the big corporations they audited. Back in my time, back in the 90s, oh hell, I would see these big companies I was consulting for, they'd have dinner with the auditors from the big accounting firm, the auditors who were going to certify their financial statements. They were friends. They were constantly trading good inside details and all this. Oh, I'm going to have you do my financial statements, auditor. Let me take you out to dinner. Okay, well, how about your wife and kids like a trip to Disney? Well, let's take that care of that for you, Mr. Outside Auditor, who's going to certify that my financial statements are in order. Sarbanes-Oxley cracked down on that relationship, that cozy relationship. Said, get them apart. No more of this kind of nonsense like that. The second thing that Sarbanes-Oxley did, Sarbanes-Oxley required that the officers and directors of a corporation sign and certify the financial statements and other SEC disclosure documents. In other words, what that meant was that back in the day, you, sir, could simply say, I was the CEO. I didn't know what this was all about. That's accounting stuff. You know, that don't hold me liable. And a court would believe you. But if you have signed that document, you have basically written off any rights you can claim to ignorance. And you, along with those auditors, you, sir, are at risk of going to prison and being the bunkmate of a guy named Bubba. That helps you focus on not say, well, I just don't know about that kind of stuff. That's the CFO. CFO says, well, they audited it. I didn't know. See, they'll hand it down the line until they find some sucker like you in the company that can go to prison. Yeah, that's exactly what they're going to do, and they still do it in banking. But Sarbanes-Oxley cracked down on it at the top of the food chain, at least in most corporations. So, and the third thing was that they made it more attractive for whistleblowers to come forward. They made it more attractive. a whistleblower who gave enough evidence to show corruption and a liquidatable value of that corruption, in other words, a dollar value of it, would get a piece of the action from the blow. Okay? That gave incentive to the whistleblowers to step up to the plate. Retaliation is part of the game. And the whistleblower laws are still lax, and I'm going to have you read what happens to whistleblowers to scare the hell out of you about being one someday. Interestingly, and this goes back to the political side, whistleblowers are going to have retaliation, regardless of laws that might, quote unquote, protect them. During the Bush administration, after SOX became the law of the land, whistleblowers came forward. A number of them were retaliated against, but a number of them saw good rewards for whistleblowing against corrupt corporate practices. Now, interestingly, there are whistleblowers. You can talk about whistleblowers in the private sector and whistleblowers in the public sector. In the public sector, whistleblowers can do everything from blow the whistle on just absolutely unspeakable things we're doing overseas to whistleblowers who tell about cost overruns and programs that the government is running. During the Bush administration, there were retaliations against whistleblowers in the private sector, and there were winners among whistleblowers in the private sector. But during the Bush administration, there were no successful prosecutions. I don't think there were even any indictments the government pursued against whistleblowers in the public sector. Not one. You move into the Obama years, and the strangest thing is that whistleblowers were still getting retaliation sometimes, winning sometimes. But in the public sector, every whistleblowers were going to prison. If I'm not mistaken, the largest number of whistleblowers in American history went to prison under the Obama administration. For things like one guy, he was a former military guy, he blew the whistle on these insane cost overruns in a project to upgrade the signal system of the United States. I mean, we're talking about literally hundreds and hundreds, nearly billions of dollars, and he's in prison now probably for the rest of his life. So it's kind of weird trying to put together how does this work. You have the conservative who didn't prosecute the public whistleblowers. You had the neoliberal who did. It's kind of weird. It gives you a different perspective on how politics works. Some things are kind of hard to match up with what your prior assumptions would be. Mm. And then there was a reform of SOX. It was touted as a reform, but I'll tell you one thing right now. A couple of our former ISU students, their alum, in the heavy top ranks of the big, big banks. And we had them here for Lifetime Achievement Awards or something like that. And the Faculty of Finance had an opportunity to have a sit down with them, just us, some snackies, and they'd talk, and we could ask them questions that we could transfer to knowledge for the classroom. My God, these guys, they started talking about the reform, the fine-tuning of Sarbanes-Ox, that is called the Dodd-Frank Act. I mean, they were talking about this like this was the most horrible thing in the universe. And at first, my natural inclination is really honestly, wah, wah, wah. Someone is going to make you grow up and pay attention and behave by decent rules. I get kind of tired sometimes. Oh, we want to be free of these restrictions. Another, just like my son used to say, you're making me do this. That's not fair. I want to do what I want to do. I kind of always take everything. But then they began to tell me some of the requirements under Dodd-Frank, and I thought, gee, Zooey, what the heck? I didn't know this. I mean, these ratio targets that they have to meet that just don't make any sense at all, and the punishments that are just kind of bizarre in some cases for accidentally, just slipping because that's how the numbers happen sometimes. Dodd-Frank, theoretically, one of its biggest provisions was to take Sarbanes-Oxley off the backs of smaller corporations. Corporations with capitalizations below $75 million would be taken, would no longer have to obey Sarbanes-Oxley. They would comply with a less onerous burden under Dodd-Frank. And there were some other things too, some other whistleblower stuff. But the big action was on these ratios that the banks had to target under Dodd-Frank. Now, there's a context to this, and if I had thought about it more at the time, I would have asked them. The whole world, at least the civilized world, the G8, as it were, the big eight economies, we have been in a series of treaties over since the 1990s to tighten the screws on the technical numbers in the financial industry across the globe, country to country. We all agree on these rules so that banks and other financial institutions can't just shop for the country with the lightest regulations. We all agree to these under treaty, these rounds of negotiations. And under our Constitution, a treaty is the highest law of the land. So that when we codify it in something like Dodd-Frank, what we are doing is actually just simply codifying what is already the law of the land under the Constitution. We agreed to these ratios and these targets and these behaviors under an international agreement that rose to the level of a treaty. And we revise that treaty in each of the rounds of this. It's called the Basel Accords. And you probably never even heard of them. The common person won't ever have heard of them. But the Basel Accords, if I'm not mistaken, someone said it's pronounced basil. I think that's the herb that you put in delicious food. But the Basel Accords, I think they're in the third generation of them now. And they try to keep all of the financial institutions across the G8 from going too far outside of the norm of all of the countries in the G8. So there's that part of it. And so as they yell about the onerous burden of Dodd-Frank, the backstory, though, is that this is where the whole world is going. So we're behaving according to a larger, broader standard that transcends our American desires with the Dodd-Frank. Welcome to the global world. Welcome to the one world government if you're a conspiracy theorist. Okay, now. Take this in context. Dodd-Frank was passed in the wake of something that I'll tell you about next week, and I just mentioned it a few minutes ago, the near collapse of the financial system of the world. Hardly anyone knows, except in the banking financial industry and in politics, the common person, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, a right-winger, a leftist, liberal, conservative, they have no clue as to how close we came to the end of the civilization. I've seen countries where the financial system, the political system, collapsed. You have militias running the streets, summary executions of your longtime enemies, destruction on a massive scale across complete entire cities, looting. Yeah, that's what would have happened if it had come to that, maybe about 2 hours. And the Federal Reserve stepped in and stopped the disaster. We'll talk about it next week. You don't have to worry about it. Well, maybe you do. Corporations. Let me turn on some lights here. It's a little dark. Okay, I'll show you something next week that'll maybe really change your world, but that's next week. Okay, companies. The first, simplest, and most common kind of company in the world, by the numbers, not by size, not by total aggregate scale, but by numbers, vastly outweighs all of the other types of companies. It is called the sole proprietorship. One person. It's just one person. You are the company. You are the company. When you die, it dies. Almost every one of you in here has been a sole proprietor. You walked dogs for the neighbor. You were a babysitter. You mowed the lawn. You were a gigolo. Okay, anything you do where you are just doing, making money, your own coin, that's a sole proprietorship. You are all at risk. So in other words, you're mowing some rich lady's lawn and you don't see her little dog, her poodle, you're... You give that dog a show dog trim. And she sues you. She can take your mower, take your truck, take everything you own, and if there's still money that you owe her in the judgment, she can take away your sister. You didn't like your sister anyway, so that's okay. Understand that a sole proprietor is all at risk. The money that you make, you report to the government, the IRS, on Form C. Then that profit you take over as income to your 1040. But then you also take that profit over to another form called Schedule SC, where you calculate the Social Security tax. And then you put that tax down on the total tax you owe. There's a line for that. And by the end of it, you're kind of sad at how much you thought you made that you didn't make. The reality is that almost no sole proprietors, as far as numbers go, very few sole proprietors ever report their income. But I'm sure every one of you, whenever you made money, you put it right on your taxes for the year. Certainly. Okay? You're not disagreeing with me. Good. But the reality is, I mean, the IRS has cracked down on this, trying to. In my other life as an artist, I go to these shows, art shows. Heck, I've even been at flea markets, craft shows, exhibitions with all the other gypsies, tramps, and thieves. And the IRS agents are prowling those. And sometimes you can tell who they are. They'll come in, they'll just be like a real regular buyer, and they'll start acting real interested in your stuff. Yeah, I was thinking of getting into this myself. You know, what kind of money do you make in this? And then they'll, if you're stupid, you'll say, I make money, and they'll go back and check to see if this person here in this booth is reporting that anything close to that income that he's telling the agent who's posing as a regular buyer. It happens. I mean, it's just so common. They're trying to crack down on this vast underground. It's called a gray market. Oddly, the gray market is massive. I mean, it's just insane. There were a couple of young PhDs in economics a few years back. It's been more than a few years, I guess. They decided they wanted to find something really interesting to write an article on to make their name. So they went, and I can't remember whether they went underground or if they went in as straight-up researchers, but they analyzed in one corporation in New York, one skyscraper, what the level of betting activity was. And we're talking about betting on everything, from horses to games of sports of any kind. And it's not just who wins. They talk about point spreads. They'll even do all kinds of statistics on individual players and what they did in a game. They'll bet on what he does in a game against what his overall is. I mean, it's just bizarre, all the different things that they do in this world of gambling. The staggering result was that after a year, they took this. Okay, this corporation had this many people and this level of activity. They extrapolated it saying, suppose that this is common, this is average for corporations, and we'll do a weighted summation of all corporations and the betting activity. The number was just mind-boggling. None of it taxed, all of it gray market. And you're talking about, if taxes were collected on this, you're talking about multiple tens of billions of dollars in lost tax revenue just because of these sole proprietors who are all at risk playing the odds in gambling of various kinds. Just that. Non-reporting and underreporting of income among sole proprietors is not just an American problem. Truth be told, some of the countries that have the worst financial problems also have the most lax collection systems on their gray markets. Greece is a great example. They're one of the primary reasons they have such big economic financial problems is not because of their liberal social programs as much as it is everyone cheats on their taxes. All of these little merchants, bread sellers, tomato pickers, everyone cheats. It's just a cultural norm. And cracking down on that is like you're offending our culture. Okay. And then there's the black market activity. Who looks right for this? You, with the backwards hat. You run a meth lab. Do you report to the IRS? IRS? Meth labs are us? No, you don't. Damn you. You need to pay taxes on it. Okay? That kind of stuff is common. Illegal activity is a huge, huge loss of revenue. There's a balance that has to be done between allowing for things to be done that are vices and the social degradation of the society by allowing them. There's a movement toward legalizing, of course, marijuana. And the logic there is that it's actually would be more beneficial than it is detrimental. Yes, you're going to have a lot of stoners wandering around saying, where's my snacks, man? And all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, the revenue we can get off those people, they don't need that money. They're wasted. Okay? So, but I mean, when we get to that meth lab, that's a different thing. You know, really? Yeah, there's great shows that come out of it, Breaking Bad and all that. But he died in the end anyway. Sort of scares me. He was a teacher. Anyway, but the point I'm trying to make is that there is black market revenue of all kinds. Everything from black market gambling, prostitution, drugs are a massive source of money that is not taxed in this black market. Truth be told, if we collected taxes, I cannot remember where I saw the number. If we collected taxes on all black market activities that happen within the borders of the United States, we would run budget surpluses and we could pay off the national debt in about 7 years. But there you go. So think of yourself, if you pay those taxes, you're doing a public service, son. Now, there's something about sole proprietorships. They can operate under DBA. A doing business as. Now in a DBA, that's what's called, in some states they call it a fictitious name, in other states they call it an assumed name. You file the right forms with the state, and remember I said this last time, companies are state entities. They are not federal. So anything that has to do with a company, other than paying your taxes and complying with federal regulations, is a state operation. So you file a form, and I've done this many times. It's just a fictitious name for yourself. And you can take it to the bank and say, well, if I have checks that are written to this, then it's me. But I've done a number of them. You simply go to the county clerk of courts. you file the paperwork requesting to use this name, a fictitious name, for your sole proprietorship. So what they'll do is they will say, all right, you filed this now. The next step is you have to get a business publication in the state to publish so-and-so wants to use this name. And if anyone has any problem with that, let me know, the publisher. You pay the publisher. I paid $35, I think, the last time I did this. And you have to keep it up there for 3 weeks, and the publisher, after 3 weeks, will send you a letter saying, no one said anything, and you take that back to the county clerk of courts and show it to them, and you got that name as long as you live. It is a doing business ask. The last one, you might see some of my work on the internet under Dark Wraith Publishing. That's a DBA. It was a DBA that I created just so to shield my own name. Interestingly, the last one I did, I actually sold the fictitious name to the corporation I created of the same name. It was Emergent Light Studio, which when I created the corporation Emergent Light Studio, I did so with the purchase of the DBA. So there was the DBA Emergent Light Studio and then the corporation Emergent Light Studio, Inc., Incorporated. DBAs are used for different purposes. It can make you look legitimate. Instead of something like your name, you could say escorts are me or moi, okay? You could do dog grooming. Instead of saying make the check out to my personal name, oh, make that out to doggies are groomed, okay, or something like that. So it's a way to make yourself look legitimate. It's also a way to separate work that you do. Sometimes a high-end company will create a DBA so that people won't know that that fancy company is doing something that may be risky or not quite as acceptable. Hotels will use DBA. Hotel chains will use DBAs for their lower-end hotels. Some of these rip-off quickie loan places, they're DBAs of respectable banks, or those respectable banks are somewhere there in the background and the DBA protects them. Sometimes you'll do a DBA because a project that you're doing is risky and you don't want your investors in your legitimate operation associating the riskier thing with the cleaner thing that you're doing. So DBAs can be used for different purposes. And a lot of times, quite honestly, with the last one I created, Emergent Light Studio, I wanted to protect the name because it had a nice sound to it. And also, it made it look like there was something bigger than I was at the time. You see, I created the DBA because I didn't know whether it would actually make it or not. And if it didn't make it, I could just throw away the papers for the DBA and it would be gone forever. But if it did make it, then I could take the next step up to being a corporation and fold that name in. So it gave me the option, it gave me more room to play to see if something that was an idea that I was going to go forward with was enough of an idea that I could make it a standing entity as a corporation. Now, the next one along the line is a partnership, and there are all kinds of partnerships. At its heart, though, a partnership is basically a sole proprietorship with more than one person. One important difference is that you can just start a sole proprietorship. You can just start it. With a partnership, for it to be legitimate, you have to file with the state your partnership agreement to legitimize it. So there's a little more formality. However, a partnership, like a sole proprietorship, all at risk. The partners jointly and severally. So if the two of you made a partnership, you screw up, you have exactly screwed up. There's no distinction between you. The partnership is mortal. When one of you dies, it dies, just like a sole proprietorship. But along the way, you two are, for all intents and purposes, married. That's why when you make a partnership, you might want to make absolutely sure that those partners of yours are rock solid. You don't make a partnership. Yeah, we were in college together and we did keggers. Yeah, so he's a bro. Don't. Well, maybe if he still can get the kegs. But the deal is that I mentioned a movie, Pursuit of Happiness. That was a partnership that Will Smith and those other guys were competing in. And they were putting them through hell, because they were going to take only the best of the best one person, because they knew that once they made him a partner, he was there and on their tab. If he screws up, that whole partnership screws up and might go down the drain. That's why if you get into a company that's a partnership, like accountants often do, or a brokerage firm, or architecture firm, some dentist, optometry shops, you are going to be put through hell before they're going to say, yes, you're a partner. Know this, again, a partnership dies when one partner dies. Now, you might say to yourself, well, I know partnerships that have been around for a century or more. Yes, because they have forward thinking, so that when one partner dies, essentially the partnership collapses and is reborn immediately without that partner with the same name. So it looks like there's continuity to the outside world, complete continuity. But technically, it is a mortal, just like you, because it is you. A marriage is actually a very good example of a partnership, because the bills of one are the bills of both. Civilly, if not criminally, the actions of one are the actions of both. That's why you take marriage quite seriously, because once you get married, if that person turns out to be some insane maniac, well, that's you too, because there is no distinction within the marriage with respect to finances and all that. Now, there's a hybrid here that is kind of like a love child right now called the LLC, the Limited Liability Company. I'm not going to go into it too much because a lot of people are forming them, not grasping what it is. The first state that actually, they were very common in Europe for centuries. But in the United States, it's very recent. Utah was the first state to allow LLCs. And then I think it's spread to all 50 states. Now, I'm not sure about that, but I think all 50 states will allow limited liability companies. Like I said, though, the understanding of what you're making when you make an LLC, I've talked to people, well, we made an LLC last week. You know what you did? Well, yeah, we made an LLC. Okay, what is the membership? In a sole proprietorship, the name of the owner is you. In a partnership, the name of the owners are the partners. In an LLC, the owners are called the members. I'm not going to go into that one too much. The pinnacle of capitalism is the 800-pound gorilla, the corporation. The corporation is a separate entity under the law. The owners are not the corporation. In a sole proprietorship and a partnership, the people are the corporation, are the company, I should say. But in a corporation, the corporation is its own entity. When I form a corporation, and I've formed quite a few over the years, the first thing you do is you choose a state of domicile. That will be the state that qualifies your corporation. Now, most of the time, I form my corporations in the state of Delaware because they have a mature business law and a court system where the judges, the magistrates, as they're called, are very informed, seasoned, educated in business, which is very uncommon, quite uncommon in the rest of the country, and even at the Supreme Court. Most of those Supreme Court justices really, really don't understand business. But there you go. But in other words, I file the articles of incorporation in Delaware. I am a domestic corporation in Delaware. In any other state of the union, I am a foreign corporation. So I formed my company, my last company, in Illinois. So I am a domestic corporation in Illinois. But when I go down to Missouri, to LA, to New York, to places like that with my art for exhibitions, that Emergent Light Studio is a foreign corporation in that state. I am operating as a foreign entity in that state. So it seems kind of weird to use that term, but it's completely accurate. I'm a foreign corporation when I do a show in suburban St. Louis. Okay, now, this you learned in accounting. Assets equal liabilities plus owner's equity. The fundamental equation of accounting. In finance, it is much, much more meaningful than just an equation. Because that right there, that plus sign, that is a wall called the corporate veil. The owners are not liable for the bills of the corporation. You see, because when I file those articles of incorporation, if I did everything according to what's right, the state Secretary of State sends me back a stamped copy of my articles that says they have qualified my corporation. Understand this. There is no such thing as government approval of anything you file at the federal or state or local level. All they will do is qualify. That's the term you use. So in other words, I filed the articles of incorporation in the with the Secretary of State in Springfield. I was qualified. That qualification document was a birth certificate. In every sense of the word, that was the state recognizing that a legal entity, a standing entity under the law, had just been born. In my case, call my corporation's name. And then you file, once you got that, you file a form with the federal government on form SS9. And the federal government provides the corporation with an FEIN, an employer identification number. That's the corporation's social security number. In every sense of the word, then, the corporation at both the state and the federal level, the state issues a birth certificate, then the federal government recognizes that birth certificate and issues a number, the corporate equivalent of a social security number. So now we have got it down so that if there's a screw up, those are the problem of the corporation. Now here's where the power to do wrong can come in. You could start a corporation. If it goes bankrupt, well, the investors are screwed, but you can't be held liable as long as you kept to the right procedures. So what you will do, and here I'm going to tell you how to make a fortune, how to become a rich person. You start a corporation, you get investors. You pay yourself a massive salary that you squirrel away. You sell stock as you can as the corporation builds up, and then the corporation goes bankrupt. All these investors, they're screwed. You then take all your money and you go on to your next deal. Hype it. You get another set of suckers to invest in. You pay yourself a massive salary. And you're becoming richer and richer. The media thinks you're an ingenious guru of business. One deal after another goes under, but every time you walk away because the corporation is liable, you are not. Over and over again, suddenly they're talking about how great you are. People want to put your name on their products. You suddenly get your own TV show. My God, you can make a fortune going from one corporation to the next doing this. Someday you might even become a politician. I understand the game. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.